WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. It's 12 noon. Coming up next, The Gary Noel Show.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Noel Show.
What is a bug? I'm in love. I'm all shook up.
And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Well, my hands are shaky and my knees are weak. I can't seem to stand on my own two feet. Who do you think of when you have such...
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel. We're here to learn how to live a longer and healthier and happier life. We always begin with the latest on health and healing, and today's no exception. We're going to be talking about how blackcurrant nectar in this university of incarnate down in San Antonio, Texas, how it allows you better exercise, reduce muscle damage, reduced inflammation. So that's good, because when a lot of people start to exercise, they get really sore. And if they don't know how to rest and rebalance, whether to use cold or hot after swelling or any strains, that could impair them. But if you're just going out for a regular, let's say, power walk, where there's no stress upon the body, unlike jogging and running, yeah, you can injure yourself. Power walking, you don't. But 16 ounces per day of the blackcurrant nectar was associated with the reductions in the activity of creatine kinase, that's a blood marker of muscle damage, by a lot. For example, you had a great benefit from that versus a placebo, and it continued for 48 hours. This was published in the Journal of Dietary Supplements, and a Dr. Hutchinson did the report and said, hey, when you're using blackcurrant nectar, which you can get in any health food store or online, and ideally try to use it on a regular basis, because blackcurrant has one of the highest ORAC, or antioxidant content, of any fruit, much more so than blueberries, blackberries, raspberries, and strawberries. It's just never used. So we want it to be used. So that gives you the heads up on that. Let's use it on a regular basis. Why? Because according to the study results, it reduces what is known as interleukin-6. That's the primary inflammatory compound. And every time you exercise, it increases, which means that you can damage your cells. You're creating a lot of free radicals. This helps interfere in that process. So something new, something easy. This was done by college students, and they did this measurement twice a day for 8 days. So how about this? What would happen if just during the normal course of a day, when you're walking up steps and working, maybe gardening, not out, actually out to a track exercising, wouldn't it also work to help reduce interleukin-6 levels? And by the way, the answer is yes. Now, from Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health comes a study about how does what we eat affect our health span and our longevity? It's a complex dynamic system, but here's what Columbia University's Mailman Center has to say, that the answer to this relatively concise question is unavoidably complex. And they were doing this study at the Butler Columbia Aging Center, Columbia University, and it was published in the British Medical Journal Biology. While most analysis have been concerned with the effects of a single nutrient like vitamin C or coenzyme Q10, and if you went to PubMed and you Googled vitamin C health benefits, tens of thousands of studies would appear. If you Googled healthy plant-based diet or Mediterranean diet health benefits, again, you would be flooded with information. Now, because I spend every day collecting information specifically that's peer-reviewed and on PubMed, then I know what's up there. Hundreds of thousands of studies supporting healthy choices. So the question is, if you have one nutrient, like vitamin C or vitamin E or vitamin D3, versus having a whole group of antioxidants all at once, which is better? The whole group of antioxidants, because there's synergy. And if you could have just one healthy food, something that would give you probiotics, good bacteria for your intestines, which means it stimulates a good immune system, or you could have a whole diet, a whole meal. Well, there's a difference between having, let's say, a glass of beet juice that has prebiotics, which is good, versus having everything else in that meal that also supports health. Again, we're looking at synergy of combining things together so that you can eat a meal. And let's say for lunch you had some beans on a plate with some starchy vegetables, rutabaga, parsnips, something that is really chewy. And then you had, let's say, a roasted garlic. Maybe you had some grilled eggplant, onion, fennel. Give a little exotic and Italian flavor to the dish. And a grain. Quinoa, red quinoa is interesting. Or red rice. Or any one of the teff or spelt or millet. So you have that. And then you have some seaweed. And there's all forms of seaweed. All of these combine to make it into your body and maximize the nutrient spectrum, a full spectrum of hundreds upon hundreds of phytonutrients, the nutrients that function as functional nutrients. A phytonutrient, an antioxidant, function in the body. They help protect your body. They stimulate the immune system. They help block cancers from forming. They help lower your blood pressure, lower your blood sugar. And that's why it's better in combination than in simply a single nutrient. Because a lot of people who don't exercise, who don't have healthy lifestyles, who are highly stressed, they won't do yoga, they won't do Pilates, they won't do mindful meditation, but they'll take a B complex because that helps with your emotions. Well, yes, but not as much. Remember, not as much as a healthier lifestyle. And that's the study. So, good news there. Again, eating healthy over your lifespan will increase your lifespan. You're going to live a longer life. And there were 1,560 older men and women in this from 67 to 84. And they got one of two diets. One was a healthy diet, one was not. And they were followed for 4 years. So it was a really good study. And you want to create homeostasis, physiological regulation. You do not want a loss of homeostasis, which is physiological dysregulation. And because that's going to show you with all kinds of inflammatory or disturbing biomarkers in your blood. So you just eat a healthy plant-based diet and you're getting all these macro and micronutrients, and that's going to help you. Also, talking about the Mediterranean diet, from Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard University comes a study about the Mediterranean diet can play a key role in preventing cognitive decline. Now, there's a lot that goes into cognition. There's a lot that goes into having a healthy brain. And by the way, I'm going to be doing a special scientific report from a brand new study that challenges everything we've been told about Alzheimer's, its causes. And it's saying that it's not the amyloid beta plaques in your brain, those little white specks and streaks that block neuron activity and synaptic activity, but it's something else. Whoa, I'll go into what that else is, and it has nothing to do with the brain. But this is brand new, and I read the study twice, so I'm going to share that with you. But in this case, we know that stress in the brain, physical stress, cortisol, which is one of your stress hormones, that will really age your brain. Inflammation in the brain, that's your alcohol, that's your fried foods, that's the typical American diet. Sedentary lifestyle, that ages the brain. So they took a group of minority ethnic individuals, and they found that the Mediterranean diet, when used in its entirety, made a big difference. This was published in Alzheimer's and Dementia, the peer-reviewed journal. And they found that the levels of six plasma metabolites were associated with lower cognitive function across all racial ethnic groups, and the levels of most of these blood metabolites were associated with adherence to a Mediterranean diet. This was published, well, it was actually presented in Medical News Today. And so, quote, we identified a few metabolites, small molecules in blood, that their levels are correlated with cognitive function, and they all are related to diet. So when you're eating a Mediterranean diet or a healthy plant-based diet or a healthy vegan diet, your brain is having healthy biomarkers, which means you're going to have healthy, longer cognition. It's that simple. And I also want to tell you about Indigo Rose Tomatoes. Again, Indigo, I-N-D-I-G-O, Rose, R-O-S-E, Tomatoes, contain an antioxidant that fights diabetes, cancer, and neurodegenerative diseases. We didn't know this before. This is from Oregon State University. So not only do dark tomatoes turn heads, but they also can offer healthier nutrients than red normal tomatoes. So start buying the purple tomato, the dark brown tomatoes. They are healthier. And why? Because they found that there are nutrients in there that make them superfoods. And so just imagine going to the farmer's market or your health food store or your regular supermarket if they sell certified organic, and buying a bunch of brown tomatoes and then juicing them. They are rich in antho, A-N-T-H-O, cyanidins, C-Y-A-N-I-N, and antioxidants that help fight several diseases, more so than normal red varieties, which also are great. Quote, there are some dark-colored tomatoes, but Indigo Rose is the only real black tomato and is the darkest that has ever been bred. It's not genetically modified or GMO-based, as many assume. People often get confused between GMO and what is a natural way of hybridization, which farmers have been using for thousands of years. It is the first improved tomato variety in the world that has anthocyanins in its fruit. Mind you, tomatoes are fruits. In fact, in 1995, I started to cross match, and you do this by stemming. You take a graft of one plant, in this case it was a tomato. No, it was a cherry. And then I matched it with another type of cherry, totally different looks and taste. And then I wrapped a resin around it. And then a wire that was coated in cotton, and I let it grow and see if it would take. Not everything does, and it did. And then I planted it, and now that is the tree that gives me what I call ambrosia cherries. And they're unique. They have this wonderful flavor and a wonderful aftertaste, and so that's what I use. So it's not genetically engineered, and nor is this particular tomato. So I want you to start buying Indigo Rose. Plant them in your backyard. And finally, something that we all should enjoy, and that is a good foot massage. There's a whole field of science on this, and it's a reflexology. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Menopause, and it talks about how foot massage effectively improves your sleep quality and reduces anxiety in postmenopausal women. And this is at the Kankakee Katrina University in Turkey. The therapeutic benefits of massage have long been recognized, and a new study suggests that foot massage in particular can help minimize a number of common menopausal symptoms, including sleep disruption, effectively extending sleep duration by an average of an hour per day. And this was published in Menopause. So, hey, during menopause transition, estrogen deficiency can lead to a number of physical and mental health conditions, including insomnia, hot flashes, vaginal dryness, headaches, and anxiety. And although hot flashes and negative moods commonly are in the menopausal cycle in some people, you can improve all those. In fact, you can reverse those as well. But that's for another story. But if you go up to GaryNoll.com, scroll down to the Townsend Letter for Doctors. I've published, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 to 80 articles there. And this goes to doctors all over the country. I did a one-year study. I was invited to present the facts of the study, the outcome, to a group of thousands of doctors in Chicago. And Dr. Martin Feldman and I went to Chicago, made our presentations. And for these people to be told and shown actual lab results of the blood workups and testimonials from the patients and video, it was so popular that then they asked, would we do an additional talk which we did for 5 hours. And they found another big room, and about 400 of these doctors joined us. And they didn't believe that it was possible to reverse any menopausal symptoms. Yeah, except with, you know, synthetic hormone replacement therapy to reverse hot flashes and bone thinning, which it will do, but at a 13% adverse reactions, heart attacks, strokes, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, colorectal cancer, and dementia. That's the side effects. With 10 million women using it and a 13% minimal adverse effect, including death, why do it when we can do it with Vitex, Dong Quai, and Fotai, and all these other practices? Anyhow, but one of the things we saw reverse in all the majority of the women was vaginal dryness, so now they could have normal relations with their partners. Hair thinning, eyebrow thinning, people regained full head of hair where they were thin and gray with natural color. So fatigue was no longer there, anxiety no longer there, sleep disturbance no longer there. That makes a big deal on a person's quality of life. Oh, and by the way, just from the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, those of you who are nightbirds, you like going out and partying and dancing, okay. Those of you who just stay up late, all right, okay. For all the kids and teenagers and young adults, college students who are up a long time at night, there's a side effect. This is what they say in this peer-reviewed study. A lack of sleep negatively impacts your immune stem cells, increases your risk of inflammatory diseases and heart disease with it. So a lack of sleep is going to end your life sooner, can, and cause your heart attacks. So chronic insufficient sleep can negatively impact your immune cells, and you don't want that. This was published in the Journal of Experimental Medicine. So that's not good. All right? Now, we're out of time for this segment of our program. However, good news for all of you. John LaBelle, who's been a friend for a long time, well, he asked, could he do another newsletter? I said, sure. So we went from a weekly newsletter, a monthly newsletter, to a weekly newsletter, and now it's going daily. And what are you getting every day? At the very least, you're getting all of my health news. You're getting it all. Everything I just shared with you over the last 19 minutes, every day that's going to come to you, and it's free. You just have to go to the website, GaryNull.substack.com, GaryNull.substack.com. If you can't do that, go to GaryNull.com and sign up. And every morning or every sometime in that day, you'll get all of the information. And then he's going to add more to it. He'll add some of my investigative reporting and some of the important nature stories, environmental issues. But right now, you're going to get everything on health and healing free every day. Okay? We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us.
There must be lights burning brighter somewhere. Got to be birds flying higher in a sky more blue.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Just want to say that let's support WBAI. All of the Pacifica stations are in trouble. They're losing, from what I'm told, $100,000 a month. And they really do not have the audience nor the pledging to keep the whole foundation alive. And that's not good. And especially our beloved WBAI. So one way we can all support the station is by becoming a buddy. And it's this simple. You'll dial the following number, 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. And just say you want to be a buddy. And then you'll, whatever you can afford to donate on a monthly basis, it'll be automatic. All right? That pays bills. That helps. And I want to thank this audience for being the top audience in donating. Leonard Lopez's audience also does very well. And by the way, please check out all the different diversity of programming, the morning shows, terrific, the weekend shows. We've got so much talent on BAI. We have a lot of really positive energy. We even have some very positive people on our local station board, all working together. So please help keep WBAI alive. Now, here's what's coming at you. One of the wisest people that we hear from is Neil Oliver. Neil has an outstanding background. He's really good at history. And he's going to tell us about the elite that has taken almost all of our money, is now about everything else as well. They want to take everything we own. And he comes at us with wisdom, sensibility, level-headed. Let's hear what he has to say, because this is about the World Economic Forum, Davos, about all the major corporations that are involved, and they're everywhere. They have hundreds of thousands of people on their side, and we have millions of not yet fully informed people on ours. The more informed a person is, the more likely they are to say no to the things that the World Economic Forum are demanding of us.
When did we, the people, become the problem? I ask this question because it's becoming increasingly clear that the agenda being pushed by those in power is anti-human, anti-people, anti-us. The Great Reset, the Fourth Industrial Revolution, the New World Order, call it what you will, but it all boils down to the same thing. Everything that's wrong in the world, from the climate to the food supply to energy supply, the whole damned lot, everything that's wrong is all our fault, and we are to be made to suffer in order to make it right. And when it's remade, it won't be for us, the many, it will be for the few. If you feel in your gut that something somewhere is badly wrong, then you're not alone. I feel it too, and have done for a long time. It's like the sensation you get when you're in a car and it goes too fast over a humpback bridge, and your insides feel flipped into the air by the momentary weightlessness. The feeling goes away when the car settles onto the road once more. But the problem we have now is that we're being deliberately kept in mid-air by one dreamt up crisis after another, so that we cannot ever relax. We cannot get back to normal, because normal is not allowed. I notice it's all gone quiet on the war in Ukraine and on COVID restrictions. Both are still on the back burner, though, ready when World War III and or lockdown is needed again. For the last few days, it's been climate code red from President Joe Biden. Here it's been all about how summer itself is the enemy, and that's our fault too. We can't be trusted to keep ourselves alive when the sun's out. We used to race to the Med in search of those temperatures so we could boast about them and the tan when we got home. I struggle to make sense of any of it. That war is also being waged on the natural order of things becomes more and more blatant, more and more obvious. Most recently, it's the bid to seize and centralise the ownership of farmland. Computer software salesman Bill Gates is now the largest private owner of farmland in the US, with more than a quarter of a million acres in 19 states. Bill Gates is not a scientist. Bill Gates is not a physician, nor any kind of virologist or vaccinologist, but has been the single most enthusiastic salesman of so-called vaccines for COVID, vaccines that do not work as advertised and that have killed or damaged people in numbers as yet unknown. He's also not a farmer, and yet he's hoovering up American farmland as hard as he can go. Ask yourself why that might be. Why does a man who is not a farmer, but who would rather we, the troublesome people, eat the synthetic meat and genetically modified food in which he is so enthusiastically invested, taking as much of the farmland as he can for himself? The man who did more than any other single individual to push experimental medical products of untested, unproven safety, products in which he was similarly invested, into every human arm on the planet, is every bit as determined to dictate what goes into our mouths as well. Ask yourself why. And just by the by, who put Gates in charge of the world anyway? In the Netherlands, the leftist World Economic Forum-flavoured government is seeking to drive farmers off the land they have farmed for generations. This is being done under the pretext of the Green Agenda, Agenda 2030, punishing the farmers for their use of the fertilisers that were foisted upon them by the state and EU-sponsored agriculture industry in the first place. This is a confected crisis, cover for a blatant objective to take land away from private people and place it under the control of the state. The message is clear. The states want us to think farmers have messed up the land, messed up the environment, messed up the world. And so now the land must be taken away from them once and for all. All across Europe now, farmers are rising in opposition to the imposition of EU policies they describe as anti-farming. The scale of the protest is breathtaking, and yet most of the mainstream media pretends it's not even happening. I say this assault on those who have worked the land that should be providing us with our food is nothing less than evil. Collectivisation of farming has been practised before, of course, by communists. It's always by communists. In the Soviet Union, the cruelest of the land grabbing focused on the demonisation of a class of people just a generation or two beyond the misery of serfdom under the Tsars, totalitarians of another sort. A minority of farmers had briefly secured ownership of some land, made enough money to build decent homes for themselves and their families. This was the group the Soviets targeted as the kulaks, a word that means tight-fisted, greedy, mean, so that the mob would turn on them. The kulaks were murdered, the women raped first. Those that survived were driven off their land and herded onto trains bound for exile in Siberia, never to return. With those that knew how actually to farm removed from the farmland, a disaster unfolded. The insanity of collective farming Soviet style caused the Holodomor, a famine that claimed many millions of lives in Ukraine and elsewhere in the Soviet Union. People descended into cannibalism to such an extent that posters had to be put up in the countryside, reminding parents it was wrong to eat their children. Anti-human, anti-people, that's the agenda now. The determination to take farmland away from farmers is also anti-nature. It's more of the same anti-human, anti-nature mindset from totalitarians who also do not care about the natural order of things. It should never have been about build back better. What is needed is back to basics, back to nature, back to normal. For thousands of years, our species didn't have any sense of owning the land. Rather, they belonged to it as hunters and gatherers of wild food. 10,000 years ago came farming and farmers, and that sense of ownership made manifest with the building of walls, the raising of tombs that meant the bones of the ancestors remained on the land they had farmed in their time as physical proof of connection to place. There was a profound and meaningful connection to the land and to the soil. Steadily, in just the last few centuries, agriculture was industrialised, and in the bid for profit and productivity, farmers were pushed to use products that were poison to the wider environment. Finally, the penny has dropped for those in power. They look on at those who own the land and see another challenge to their outright control, another enemy to be defeated or erased. The farmers who cooperated with systems in order to meet targets and stay afloat are now being made scapegoats for consequences over which they had no control in the first place. Now the land itself is being taken from us, from the people. Farmers are being offered money to leave, sell up, abandon the farms their families have worked since a time out of mind. That land is being bought not by young farmers with a view to continuing ancient traditions, but by corporations and asset management companies that will ensure nothing grows there at all. If they have their way, the little people will be fed from labs with synthetic meats and infinitely processed plant-based abominations that, judging by sales in supermarkets, hardly anyone wants. Frustrated by our human insistence on real foods, real beef, lamb and pork, real vegetables grown in fields, were to be separated from the soil once and for all. Anti-human, anti-nature, it's all around us. We've been made a wasteful species, encouraged to use once and throw away, turning our backs as millions of tons of good food are bulldozed into landfill. The so-called green agenda is predicated upon the rape of the earth for rare minerals, lithium and cobalt and more, also metals like copper, silver and gold. The extraction of those commodities means wholesale destruction of environments. Before a single turbine is raised or solar panels set in place, the sites are cleared and sterilised of all life. The turbines are held up by massive plugs of concrete. While in action, they kill millions of birds. When they come to the end of their working lives, there's nothing to be done with the colossal blades but to bury them in vast landfill sites. There's plastic everywhere, in the landfills and in the rivers and the sea. During the pandemic, the production of plasticised masks, testing kits, PPE equipment, all plastic, went into overdrive. Where are the activists to complain about the billions of masks and the rest now in the ground and in the oceans, throttling the life out of marine creatures, steadily dissolving into the microplastics that will end up in our bodies as we consume the fish? More and more, we've been separated from the land and from nature. We've been systematically uneducated so that we don't know where food comes from. We do not know how to grow food, how to raise livestock. Connection to the growing and rearing of our food should be intrinsically human. Eating food reared and grown organically, close to our homes, rather than mass-produced on factory farms, shrink-wrapped in plastic and flown for thousands of miles, is the very making of healthy, happy people. This is being taken from us for profit, but more fundamentally because it's part of separating us from the natural world itself. The same elite that has taken almost all the money is now after everything else as well, including the land beneath our feet. All the time, more and more plans are demonstrably and obviously afoot to separate us from what has always mattered, from each other, from our landscapes, and even from the creation of the food we eat and the water we drink. More and more of us are fat, unfit, rattling with pills. Fewer and fewer people are happy. We're in the process of being colonised by corporations and companies. They've come for the land. If we're not careful, we'll be herded onto reservations next. That's not a joke, by the way. I've said it before and I'll keep saying it. It doesn't have to be this way. Look now to the farmers, those that are being bullied off their land and out of existence. There's so much we need to remember and to relearn, and awareness of the land is part of it, in fact, central to it. The relearning should start with the land, with the soil. It should start with teaching a child how to care for a single seedling. We come from the soil, and one way or another, we go back to it in the end. While we're here, we should remember that we own it, that the land is ours by right, and that it is our obligation, our responsibility, our right and privilege to care for it so that it can do what it has always done, which is care for us.
Again, that was Neil Oliver you were just listening to. Now we're going to go one step further, the metaverse. It's worse than you thought. Remember when I played you on several occasions a clip from Professor Harari, who is the leading spokesperson around the world, this so-called great intellect, and I see him a lot of places, and he said, and he didn't apologize, he continued to say that the majority of the people in this world are useless and worthless, and we're going to have to give them something in a virtual reality. And of course, they got it. We got to get under their skin, and he was very specific: under the skin, with digitalized chips, so we can control everything in their life. And they'll just sit all day and with one of these metaverse virtual realities and go to La La Land. Here's why it's worse and why you should pay attention to this by Moon.
Facebook's new metaverse is terrifying. The metaverse is a new augmented reality where users will live inside a digital universe. A digital universe where you can meet your friends, find new people, do business, sell meta-only content, go to church, catch up with your family, travel across dimensions, and even fill virtual objects as though they were real. Already, people are getting married inside the metaverse, businesses are setting up shop in the metaverse, and Snoop Dogg is buying virtual property in the metaverse. And now fans of Snoop Dogg are paying hundreds of thousands to buy virtual land next to their idol. Because we're now at a point where even Snoop Dogg is looking to create his own universe called Snoopverse, with all of this happening inside Zuckerberg's all-encompassing metaverse, where what you see, hear, and feel is entirely controlled by Mark Zuckerberg. This is a gigantic process that Russell Brand refers to as the colonization of consciousness. Because Facebook is doing everything it can to create a monopoly on human existence, where society and culture is imported into a universe run by a megalomaniac. This all may seem like some sort of gimmicky marketing. It may seem impossible. I mean, how on earth could a social media company create their own universe? At least these were my first thoughts. But after making a video on the metaverse, I began to find out more and more about the absolute insanity of the metaverse. It became very clear to me that this is a project more evil than I could have possibly imagined. And here's why. Mark Zuckerberg's expansion into the metaverse comes as other billionaires are venturing into new realms. As Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk expand into space, Zuckerberg is expanding his monopoly into human consciousness. Now, Facebook is already the 8th biggest company in the world, with control over 2 billion users worldwide. Facebook alone already has 5 times the amount of active users than any other social media company, and Instagram is following suit. But for Zuckerberg, this wasn't enough. If Facebook was to monopolize human consciousness and control an entirely new reality, Facebook needed to lure people in. Because once enough influential people, businesses, and cultural groups are in, everyone else then has no choice but to jump into the metaverse or face extreme outcasting. So the first step for Facebook to lure people into its new reality was to dominate the virtual reality market, which is why in 2014, Facebook acquired Oculus Rift for a total of $2 billion. Now, Oculus, for those who don't know, controls 75% of the virtual reality market, and this number will only continue to grow as Facebook sets to subsidize these exact headsets to increase their availability, also that Facebook can start to hook us in with our first free hit. It really won't be much longer until you're being offered a subsidized or even free headset to lure you into the metaverse. But even still, you wouldn't really have any real reason to stay in the metaverse for extended periods of time or even join the metaverse in the first place. The only way Facebook could addict you to extract the most amount of money from your data, privacy, and consciousness would be to envelop society as a whole, which is why Facebook is actively working to control our reality in three key ways. Through religious control, economic control, and political control. If Facebook could get religious groups, social groups, businesses, shops, workspaces, news, and political groups to be sucked into the metaverse, then you yourself would have no other choice but to join in, which would then allow Facebook to reshape an entire culture, an entire generation of people. They just needed to trick enough users, or what Zuckerberg refers to as dumb fucks, to join in and become addicted. That's exactly why during the development of the metaverse, Facebook developers have been regularly meeting religious leaders. For example, religious leaders like Sam Collier, the pastor for the megachurch Hillsong. The church was approached by Facebook, with the proposition being that the church could gain far-reaching expansion if they were to join in on the metaverse. All they had to do was become exclusive to the metaverse. This was an offer that was all too tempting in a world that continually shuns away the church from regular life. So the Hillsong Church agreed and is now in an exclusive partnership with Facebook. This is far from just an anomaly. Since 2017, Facebook has been courting all sorts of religious leaders to lure them into joining the metaverse. But why is Facebook doing all of this with unknown religious leaders? Well, according to Facebook's chief operating officer, Sheryl Sandberg, Facebook hopes to, quote, host religious services in virtual reality spaces, as well as use augmented reality as an educational tool to teach children the story of their faith. With Bishop Robert Barron claiming that Facebook is now giving people, quote, the kind of intimate experience of the mass they wouldn't normally have.
Imagine this for a second. One man with total control of billions of people's stolen data, all their secrets, their lives, their futures. Whoever controls the data controls the future.
But in our society, we no longer value church, religion, community, and spirituality. Instead, we've abandoned these things for a new religion, relentless consumerism, where most of us are so devoid of either ambition or interest, we have nothing to fear and nothing to hope. We're a populace without religious belief to imbue our existence with transcendental meaning. We are, as Nietzsche described, the last men, the people who have lost all meaning in their lives whilst never being fulfilled by anything and contributing nothing of value. So the question is, what is left for us? Well, it's simple. Consumerism and entertainment. That's why most of us are vapid, tawdry consumers looking to stuff the empty pit inside of us to give us any sense of purpose. So if Facebook were going to pull in the masses to the metaverse, they would need to pull in the money, the shops, the clothes, the businesses, the celebrities, all the entertainment. Which is why we're already seeing virtual reality becoming the norm. Justin Bieber, for example, has already been paid off to perform a live concert within the metaverse. And with this concert, investors have been eagerly buying up online concert venues. It's why Louis Vuitton, Gucci, Burberry, and all these other major clothing brands are buying up NFTs in the metaverse. Dolce & Gabbana have just sold their own high-end fashion for a record $6 million in the metaverse. And investors are now buying up shopping malls, properties, all within the metaverse. Because experts are now predicting that the metaverse will foster a brand new flourishing economy. And this isn't just something in the far future, this is happening in a matter of years. And it's no joke, because it means the real-world economy will be subsumed by the virtual. And now this may not seem all too bad, until you ask yourself, how does Facebook benefit from any of this? Well, Facebook will have total power. Facebook will dictate the brands that are sold, the small businesses run, the land you own, and the sites you see. Which means Facebook could choose to ban you for whatever reason it deems fit. Facebook could literally control the value of your business through its advanced algorithms. And if you don't believe me, Facebook is already engaging in this sort of activity as I speak. Facebook is using Sentra to track its users not just on Facebook, but across the entire internet. Sentra tracks different profiles that a user visits, their message recipients, their linked accounts, the pages they you visit. It then centralizes all of this information within its databases. Facebook then uses this with this other program called Tasks. Which allows Facebook's censorship team to communicate with other big tech firms so that they can coordinate censorship across all platforms. This means that Facebook can control businesses not just within Facebook, but across the entire internet.
The Tasks platform allows Facebook employees to communicate about projects they're working on together. That includes Facebook's censorship teams, including the so-called community well-being team, the integrity team, and the hate speech engineering team, who all use the Task platform to discuss which individuals or hashtags or websites to ban.
And what's more is that through all of this tracking, Facebook has gained unparalleled amounts of your personal information. This is why we've all had that weird experience when our devices try to sell us products after merely just talking about it with friends and family.
Toys are what I'm the most interested in right now. If I were to buy something right now, it would be dog toys. First website up. Oh my God! It's right there.
Social media is now so effective at modeling and categorizing our behaviors and predicting what we're likely to buy next that companies like Facebook already know our interests before we've even typed it up. But just imagine what this means for the metaverse. When you go shopping in the metaverse, when you go to concerts, when you meet your friends in your virtual houses, when your entire life and all your interactions are being fed into an algorithm that exploits you, this is a recipe for disaster. Instead of just going to a Justin Bieber or Travis Scott concert, you'll be going in metaverse concerts that track the exact songs at the exact moments you showed signs of enjoyment. The metaverse will know the dances you do and the other metaverse users that you were attracted to, with all of this data going to a man who is consistently questioned in Congress, a man whose whole story is plagued with unethical business practices, a man who causes users dumb f**ks, who uses sophisticated brain science and behavioral modeling to addict you to his products, who depresses you deliberately, who makes you anxious, who makes you mentally ill, all to hook you into his algorithms so that you can feel a temporary sense of passive numbness while he sells off your privacy. So then this brings up the very important question. Do we trust Mark Zuckerberg to own reality? To me, I can't shake off the feeling that Mark Zuckerberg's digital utopia has uncanny parallels to the utopian visions that define the nightmares of the 20th century. You see, this is where the metaverse begins to take a much more sinister turn. If you're going to take anything from this video, this next section is of vital importance, because this could be one of the worst things to have ever happened in the 21st century. Now by this point, you'll most likely be wired into the metaverse, as all your friends, community, religious groups, celebrities, businesses, and shops are all operating within it. But the final question is, how do you stay in the metaverse permanently? Well, to keep you hooked, the metaverse will make you feel incredible, because after every meta game you play, after every meta friend you meet, after every meta concert you watch, there will be a rush of dopamine saturating your brain. You'll never want to leave. You can be what you want, do what you want, when you want, and then you'll repeat this cycle every day of every week of every month of every year. Jump into the metaverse, go to work in the metaverse, meet friends in the metaverse, play games in the metaverse, party in the metaverse, find love in the metaverse. In the metaverse, you will never have to use your imagination again. You will never have to think for yourself, because all of that is done for you. All the thoughts you have, all the opinions you hold that don't conform to the party line will gleefully be scrubbed from your consciousness. And if you still don't see why this is a terrifying prospect, we need to look into the consequences this brings. The metaverse will put you under a massive illusion. After making money in the metaverse, you'll feel productive. After falling in love in the metaverse, you'll feel incredible. After buying land in the metaverse, you'll feel accomplished. All your problems will disappear. You'll finally have community. You feel like you're achieving something great, like your life is finally intact. And it's this feeling of accomplishment that brings you back to the metaverse every single day. But it's only when you take off the headset and look around you do you realize you're a lab rat. You haven't achieved anything. You're alone, you're empty inside, you haven't made any progress, you were just tricked into thinking that you did. You haven't achieved anything. And what's even worse is that behind this whole addiction is something even more sinister. Your artificial life, your virtual memories and experiences are going to someone else, someone who's winning, someone who's in control of your entire life. You see, Mark Zuckerberg is delighted by the idea of a population that can no longer think for themselves, a nation of passive consumers bowing down to the throes of big tech billionaires. But once Facebook's got the users addicted to this virtual reality, they need to make sure that there is no dissent that might break the population's trance. Because if you're going to run a universe for the benefit of a few, it's very dangerous to let people have their own thoughts. The only way you can effectively make your users passive, obedient citizens is through fear and silence. Free speech is the most dangerous thing for the metaverse's continued existence. Because free speech doesn't exist for those in power, the point of free speech is to secure the rights of the unpopular. Free speech is the only thing that allows contrary opinions to exist. So, if free speech were to exist in the metaverse, that would be gravely inconvenient for Zuckerberg. It impedes his technocratic utopian vision. It's a threat to his authority. It's what gives way to a meta insurrection. It's exactly for this reason that we've seen supposed thought criminals being wiped from social media, whose businesses and livelihoods are stripped away for asking the wrong things. By this point, it's a known fact that Silicon Valley is defined by its intolerance of dissent, by their encouraging of groupthink, their control of what people believe. In fact, it's for this reason that so many journalists and commentators are no longer able to question big pharma and government actions. That's why there are no more Edward Snowdens. That's why, more often than not, the powerful are no longer held accountable. Because big tech censorship doesn't just destroy expression, it destroys thinking and innovation. Censorship leads to self-censorship. People learn what they're allowed to express and what they're allowed to believe. We become narrow in our thinking, art dies, banality takes its place, science becomes impossible. And if you don't like that, you'll be banned from the metaverse. And no, this won't be a normal ban. You'll be missing vital communication. You'll be banished from your community. You'll be ostracized and left in the strands of the forgotten real world. Already, those whose politics differs from the technocratic plutocracy are banned from vital functions of the virtual world. For example, PayPal and even Airbnb all take down accounts of people's views they oppose. So you better not express your true thoughts. No normal person in their right mind supports any of this. No one born and socialized into Western values would even have to think about this. No, instead, this comes from billionaires like Zuckerberg, who are eagerly working to control society, to take away the power of the masses. This is how they get control. Because once Zuckerberg can dictate your political opinions, he can then dictate almost anything else. That's why in the metaverse, there will be no backlash. How could there be, when almost all of the conversation is controlled by Facebook anyway? This is power, the likes of which we've never seen before. No one voted for Mark Zuckerberg. He's a megalomaniac worth over $70 billion. In fact, he might be one of the most unpopular people on the planet. And yet, he will be the one in control of our new reality. And even more worrying, no one is here to defend us, because no one has the power to anymore. Governments around the world all rely on Mark Zuckerberg and all the other tech giants to stay in power. But there is one other player in the game, another player that will have total control of our reality, a player even more creepy than Mark Zuckerberg, the CCP. Now, I bring up the CCP a lot in my videos, but for this point, it's extremely important that we understand the power the CCP will have over the metaverse. Because as the metaverse becomes the new reality for the global population, China could effectively control the metaverse's entire sphere. China could effectively control the infrastructure behind the metaverse, thanks to China's Digital Silk Road Initiative, which finances a miscellany of countries' telecommunications systems. China is gaining more and more control of the physical switch. China is doing everything it can to buy up servers and internet infrastructure. And China's not only going after our telecommunications systems, but China is now going after the core components needed to fuel the metaverse. It's for this reason that China is pushing us closer and closer to World War III. China is vehemently training for an invasion of Taiwan, surrounding Taiwan with 150 fighter jets. China is continually training its troops to land on the coast of Taiwan. In fact, China is now even practicing invading the Taiwan presidential building. So why is China risking a third world war? Well, because Taiwan dominates the semiconductor industry that supports all of our computing needs. China understands that we are falling down the rabbit hole of big tech and virtual reality. That's why if China controls the resources needed to sustain our virtual atomized augmented addiction, China will likely become even more of a linchpin on the global stage. This power over the physical infrastructure will then in turn be vulnerable to Chinese hacking and communist influence over the minds of Meta users. If people are owning their property, earning a living, and building relationships in the metaverse, then any deliberate service outbreaks will completely destroy everything we live for. Because outside of the metaverse, we won't have anything to show for ourselves. When all the key pillars of society are taken into the metaverse, our real reality will be a barren, empty, nihilistic land. landscape, a wasteland of passive non-consumers who are addicted to escapism, unable to ever reach the levels of satisfaction the metaverse provided. Our only way of escaping the evil that is the metaverse is to create meaningful lives. Lives that feel visceral disgust by living in a dystopian virtual reality. We need to create better role models than megalomaniac billionaires and vapid celebrities. We need to reassess the true value of physical connection, not just connection based around hedonistic impulses, boorishness, and nihilism. Instead, we need lives based around stoicism, discipline, responsibility, and decency. We need to build the inner character within ourselves to reject this poisoned junk. We need to turn our back on a metaverse that's sterile and hollow, and re-empower the parts of our lives that have been destroyed by big tech giants in the first place.
Frightening? Yes. Is it happening in the future? No, it's happening right now as we speak. But also, I read an interesting article, and then I got the video of it, 11 reasons an annual COVID booster is not like an annual flu shot. And mind you, this is from a mainstream board-certified physician that you would never have heard in the past challenging anything like this, in my opinion. But he, along with thousands of other mainstream doctors, are now challenging. Oh, by the way, next Wednesday, we have an MD, PhD coming on who is probably the most knowledgeable person or one of the two most knowledgeable people that I could find to talk about what they're finding in some blood of people who have been vaccinated, these tangles, these self-organizing lipid nanoparticles that are growing and how long they can grow. One was 2 feet long, but they're finding this is a primary cause of blood clots and dying. Let's listen to what and watch what he has to say. And you can go to prn.live, scroll down to Gary's show and notes, and then you'll see where you can go to the video and watch this in real time. So please go down, and it'll be 11 reasons an annual COVID booster, 19 booster, is not like an annual flu shot.
Recently, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration authorized a bivalent vaccine, 50% Wuhan, 50% BA4-5. It was authorized on the basis of experiments with 8 to 12 mice. No human trials were conducted. And critics of this vaccine say that the FDA has lowered the bar too low for an additional booster dose of a bivalent vaccine. Proponents say that it's just like the flu vaccine. We have a new flu vaccine each year. We don't always run human trials before we do it. We go abroad. We go to Australia. We go to Asia. We figure out what strains might be coming to the U.S. and we make a vaccine from that. That's how we do flu. That's how we can do COVID-19. So the COVID-19 shot and the flu shot, are they the same thing? In this video, I'm going to give you 11 reasons why the analogy is entirely misplaced. It is completely farcical. It's absolutely wrong. And anyone who says it is pushing propaganda rather than science. So here are my 11 reasons. Number one, the COVID-19 vaccine is far more reactogenic. It's far more reactogenic. It has higher rates of adverse events than the flu vaccine, and that's a salient difference. The flu vaccine, after people got it, never resulted in people taking a day off work the next day. People didn't routinely take a day off work, but that's different with the COVID-19 vaccine. Reactogenicity or immunogenicity and adverse events in the short term are objectively higher with the COVID-19 vaccines. It has more myalgia, muscle aches, fever, chills, night sweats than the flu vaccine. I think that's obvious for anyone who's looked at this issue. So that's one difference. Why? But we got 10 more to go. Number two, the flu vaccine tries to predict what strains might be coming to North America, whereas the COVID-19 vaccine is built on strains that have already been to North America. They've already come. They've already been here. It's a fundamental difference. When we make the flu vaccine, we look abroad. We try to pick the types that we think will play a role in our fall season. We may not always get it right, and that's why vaccine effectiveness against flu can be so volatile and so poor year to year. But with the COVID-19 vaccine, we're not even trying. We're not trying to predict what might come. We're giving you 50% Wuhan, which, by the way, is not in circulation anymore, and 50% BA4-5, which has already swept through America. So it's not about what's coming in the future. It's about what's been here in the past. And that's salient difference number two. Let's go to number three. COVID-19 is actually currently the infection fatality rate is less lethal than flu. So this is another important difference. COVID-19 is less lethal than the flu. I'm going to put up on the screen either my favorite graph from Financial Times showing the IFR over time in the United Kingdom, showing that it has actually passed the influenza threshold downward, or maybe a graph from Financial Times showing the IFR by age, showing that the COVID-19 IFR is now lower in 2020. We're not talking about, 2022. We're not talking about 2020. We're talking about the present moment. We have to make policy for the present moment. And it's currently less lethal. And that's a salient difference. And it's also far less deadly or harmful for younger people than seasonal influenza. And that's yet another reason why you might want to have a different policy. Number four, maybe, just maybe, this whole analogy between the COVID-19 shot and the flu shot might make us rethink the flu vaccine's evidence. Just because we've been doing something for 20 years or more doesn't mean we have to continue that in the future. The current level of evidence for the annual flu shot is animal data, and then just debuting the vaccine widely, and then looking later in a test-negative case-control fashion, a particular type of study design, to evaluate the vaccine effectiveness. But as I've talked about on this channel, and as I've talked about on my Substack, test-negative case-control designs are potentially inaccurate. They can be plagued by selection bias, they can have built-in confounding, and they don't always give you a reliable estimate. I believe they tend to be upwardly biased. And previously in my Substack, Vinay Prasad Observations and Thoughts, I've debunked many test-negative case-control studies. So I guess it's an important question, which is why do we have to use test-negative case-control to prove vaccine effectiveness for flu? We could run randomized controlled trials. The makers of the flu shots are getting plenty of money. We could have them run a study in the Southern Hemisphere to give us a future glimpse as to what that vaccine might do in the Northern Hemisphere. So I think if anything, a lesson of this comparison is we should be demanding better evidence for flu shots, and we certainly need better evidence for this COVID-19 bivalent booster. That's the opinion of many people, which I will come to in this 11-point series. Number five, it's a novel platform, mRNA, and there are unknown unknowns that we still don't know. Now, it's a bit trite to say they're unknown unknowns, but there are, and it's an important thing. And when you approved the first COVID-19 vaccine by EUA, sorry, when it received an emergency use authorization, not an approval, an EUA, in the fall of 2020, we could reasonably estimate the known risks and benefits and the unknown risks and benefits. And it was abundantly clear that whatever was unknown couldn't possibly outweigh the known benefit to, say, a 70-year-old person who was unvaccinated who could get COVID-19. That known benefit was so tremendous in the randomized control trials that there wasn't anything out there that could be a signal that could swamp that. But as you move forward into booster after booster after booster, year after year, novel constructs without randomized data, the balance of known and unknown risks and benefits shifts substantively. And now we're in a situation where we just simply don't know what will happen to somebody if they get 4, 5, or 10, or 25 boosters with mRNA. And that's different than flu, which does not use a novel platform like this. Some things you just learn with time. Number six, the FDA commissioner. There was this very interesting quote by Bob Califf, the FDA commissioner. I'm going to put it.
Mind you, what you just saw and heard was from mainstream. Now we have the voices that have been silent but have known the truth or finding the truth, speaking the truth. We're out of time, everyone. Let me just mention also that coming up on October 2nd at 1 p.m., a fundraiser for WBAI, and it's the world premiere of my new film, which I was going to wait until I come back to New York, but they need the money now. So we're doing this. It's going to take hours to watch because you're going to see the director's cut. That's the long cut of a multi. It's just winning awards all over the world. And it's not even out to the public yet. It is science for hire, which means science for sale, which means what you've been led to believe may not be true at all. So it's October 2nd, which is a Sunday at 1 p.m. To be a part of this, you're going to have to call in. You can call in at this number. 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, or go to GaryNall.com. I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day, everyone.
The live concert in Times Square for International Peace Day on Wednesday, September 21st, Ecologic still has VIP seats available for a donation of $100 to WBAI.
The array of talent is so huge, we don't have time to list them all.
You're going to love being in the front row.
Go to www.give2wbai.org.